We are Brightside.
But Eddie, you got to see it.
I want you to send that to me. I want you to send that to me.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll send that to you.
That's awesome.
but yeah. all right. What, John, why are you a Chargers fan?
Well, when I was younger, we lived like 90 miles from Pittsburgh. And that's when the Steelers.
You're still not helping your case, but go ahead.
I understand. I'm going to tell you why. The Steelers were winning Super Bowls. They were everywhere. Everyone liked the Steelers. I didn't like Terry Bradshaw because I thought he looked like an old bald guy. And I liked Dan Fouts because he had the beard.
Yes.
And I liked the uniforms. It was really why I liked them. Was the uniforms and Fouts' beard was just the opposite of Bradshaw and the boring ass Steeler uniforms that were, you know, just that dinky logo in black.
Yeah. The flat black helmet, the logo on one side.
I couldn't stand them. But as I got older, I figured it, much like people who didn't like the Patriots during your heyday.
Right, right.
Hating the Steelers was just a waste of time because they're good every year. So I don't hate them so much anymore, but I didn't like them. I just did not like Pittsburgh when I was younger. I liked the Chargers uniforms, and I just followed them ever since.
Yeah. What's funny is that you say that, and it's like it struck a nerve with me because I was a Patriots fan growing up. Loved Steve Grogan.
The neck roll guy.
Yeah. That's the opposite of what you're saying about Bradshaw. Like Steve Grogan was the old guy, but he could take a beating. I mean, because we had, oh my God, we got John Hanna. He's the best lineman he's the best lineman on the worst team in the world. That's why he's the best lineman. It's like he could stop everybody. They just went around the other side of the dam that wasn't there and would just crush Grogan. But I always liked the Chargers. It was to you, like exactly like you said.
They I had love those, the uniforms.
The That's, uniforms.
I was just a kid. I was,
yeah.
Eight, you know,
the lightning bolts on the shoulders, that dark navy.
You know, no,
I don't like the powder blue. Yeah,
down.
Yeah, and it's. I remember my parents, and this was when I was older. I was probably 17, and my parents went on vacation out to not vacation. My dad had to go out to California for a job for work, and all I wanted was like. I didn't know, like, even at 17, I'm so stupid with stuff. I'm like, well, California, that's San Diego, right? Okay. But it's like, that's the whole East Coast is California pretty much. And they weren't even close, but I'm like, get me a Chargers shirt. That's what I wanted. I wanted a Fouts Chargers shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it. And then obviously I didn't get it. They didn't get it. Not obviously, but I never got one. But yeah, same thing. It's like the Patriots sucked. I was still a huge Patriots fan. Loved the logo. I loved the whole thing, but there was just something about that Chargers, the navy blue, the lightning bolt. It was like the blue and gold. I mean, it just is. I mean, yeah, it's funny you say that. And you're like in the opposite direction. Yeah, Pittsburgh was just so good. Okay. How many people go in that direction? You know, like
I just didn't like them. I didn't like them. Never did.
But hey, we're kind of burying the lead here with this is what John and I do on Patreon all the time is just. Mm-hmm. BS. And we got your brother here. Finally, Eddie, nice to meet you. Eddie in the car. We call Eddie is like really wanted to sit down with us so bad that what kind of vehicle you're in there, Eddie?
Toyota Tacoma.
Nice. I got a Tacoma. My son's got my Tacoma. I got a Tundra. Nice. That's nice. Awesome.
Tundra's too. I live in the middle of Atlanta. Tundra's too big.
Yeah. Yeah.
Way too big. My truck gets banged up enough in the city, let alone having a Tundra.
Yeah, I got, it's funny, I have a, my Tundra, I got in, 2016, and I got it in 2017, and it was part of Tuukka Rask, the goalie for the Bruins, was part of his contract. And the guys at the dealership I'm at know I'm a huge Bruins fan, and they're like, Tuukka's turning in his Tundra. He's like, do you want it? And I was in the market to get I needed a new truck. My Tacoma had almost 400,000 on it. So nice. I'm like, yeah. And it was a year old, fully loaded Tundra. And I'm like, yeah, this is great. And it's still got Tuukka Rask's name in it and everything. But the reason he was trading it in, he lived in town. He lived in Boston. It was too big to drive around town. So they gave him a Tacoma. I don't know what he did with that. I'm like, it's a free car. It's part of his contract. So
That's like John Voight's vehicle on Seinfeld.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's, that's like real stuff. Like these athletes, they get this stuff. I remember I was at a Volvo dealership with Nomar Garciaparra. They gave him a car. It's just all part of their deal. Like, yeah, hey, take a picture. Here you go. That's it. Free car. Nice.
So, yeah. Must be nice.
I wouldn't know. I gotta pay for celebrities' cars. But luckily, it's all mine now. All paid off. It's all mine. I own it. It's $260,000 on it now.
Nice.
Still going. Yeah. So enough sports and vehicle talk. Eddie, damn. This John and I, but I'm sure he told you, we've been talking about this for years and years. I said to John the other day, I'm like, it was like 2 years ago. And John's like, nope. It was longer than that. And I'm like, I didn't even know I had a podcast this long that we've been talking about having you on about Hazard, which is coming out just in as when this comes out, just in literally 10 days up here.
January 10th.
Yeah, January 10th. And this podcast comes out on the 31st. So yeah, 11 days, 10, 11 days.
Nice.
I've heard like it, debuted at Sundance, correct?
No, not at all. Premiered at Woodstock Film Festival in New York, then went to the Bahamas and, now we're just in theaters.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Cause it says it's like a 2024 film. So because you premiered there, it gives it that year. And not 2025.
You're looking up a wrong. There's another Hazard movie that was a foreign movie that opened in 2024.
No, this is the one with Sosie Bacon, Stephen Ogg.
That's it.
Yeah, and it's saying 2024, rated R.
Yeah. Well.
And I would like to compliment you on your technical aspects here. Color. Really happy about that. I was busting John's balls about that last week. I was like, nice, it's in color. Woo!
What, the mine was too dark?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. Well, mine 9 was in color, but that was dark. That was a great movie. Great movie. Great home theater movie. I did a whole podcast on it. Did you hear it?
I heard it. Yeah. I heard it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, oh my God. It was.
I appreciate you doing that.
Oh, no. I appreciate the film. Oh my God. It's like, I wish it was bigger. I wish more people knew about it. And we're sending a link to people that you sent over last week. Cause it is harder to find now, especially, one of my listeners in Australia, he can't find it. And it was like, so that's why you sent it over. And I sent it to, Paul Hurt too the other day over in England. So he's going to check it out. But my God, for a home theater movie too, it's like, what did you do that one? 5.1, right? It's just 5.1 on Blu-ray. You can get it on Blu-ray. I think. What did I say it was, John? Like $13 in the States?
It was, but it's hardly on there now. It was on Amazon the other day for like $30.
Oh, 30 now.
We're getting it back up. Our distribution deal expired this past year, and I got my rights back to it. So I haven't signed another deal because I'm weary of, you know, these deals you sign. You sign your life away for like 7 to 10 years and, you know... We played on Netflix and Showtime and did a bunch of stuff with it. But, you know, I need to make sure I do the right deal this time.
Yeah.
And it's not with the previous company.
Yeah. I've heard stories like that. The first story I heard like that was in the other industry, a record industry. It was Springsteen. And he signed his life away on the trunk of a car. It's like a famous, and he ended up having to sue his manager and everything because he signed everything away. And that was where, if you hear about like all of the songs that he's written for other people, it was during that time he couldn't record anything because he didn't own it, but he could write and sell it. And then he'd own that. But that's where you hear all these other songs from other artists by him. And it is so hard as an artist. I've been following it my whole life. My uncle's an artist and, you know, I'm deep into the world. In all aspects, looking for their rights, looking for this and that, and how hard it is. Because you'll give your life away because you just want to create. And it sucks for people like yourself or anybody. Like, that's where you get the term starving artist. Like, take it. I just want to make more. And you never really get compensated. So I hope you do. Especially with this one. I really do. I hope you do on this one.
I'm holding this one closer to the vest. You know what I mean? But
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the smartest things like Stallone did. With Rocky, they tried to sign his life away and he refused and refused. And it's just, you know, and it's like, for all the Adrian, and they think he's stupid. He's a smart businessman. He knew what he was doing, and he believed in himself, right? And
he's a wonderful businessman.
Yeah. It's insane.
So, yeah.
But yeah, it's when you're just starting out, it's like you're just so excited to do it. And then you're like, yay, somebody's paying me. And then you're like, oh, crap, I could have got more, or I should have got more, or I should have done this. So, but yeah, that's what I saw Mine 9 on Netflix. That's what John had told me about it then. And I bought the Blu-ray after the fact, but I saw it on Netflix and it played awesome there, even in the theater. Cause it's that, I mean, it's about being in the mines and that entire, I mean, everything, talk about claustrophobic. And if you're in a dedicated theater watching that movie, I mean, it's scary as hell. It really is.
We played in a bunch of multiplexes all over, and my favorite screening, I've told John this, because I don't know anything about home theater, so this is the only thing that I can potentially add to the home theater conversation. Facet Cinematheque is a little indie movie theater in Chicago, and it's only like probably a 50-seat theater, and it's the only one we played at that plays on Blu-ray. And they had their 5.1 dialed in their Blu-ray of the movie. And it was the best projection, better than any of the DCP projectors for multiplexes. It was unreal the way they had that dialed in.
That's awesome. Yeah. And that the sound in that, the way, like, I want to say catacophic. I don't even know if that's a word, but just the envelopment that you get because it is so claustrophobic. I mean, you're getting close up. How was that to film? Like, are you just shooting at, because some of the, like when I watch a movie a second time, like watching Mine 9 the second time, those scenes in the, you know, down in the mines, I got to imagine, like, I always like to like think of the other side of the camera, right? So these people are supposed to look like it's like harrowing and dying and thing in the dark and dim and all this. And then on the other side of the camera, you're like, all right, I need this. I need that. Like, it's like completely the opposite. It's like, where did you film all that?
We went to Richlands, Virginia to a coal mine, and we filmed at the coal mine for about a day and a half. And we filmed real coal miners operating all the equipment and everything. So anytime you see a wide shot or a shot from behind or a shot on the shoulder or something, it's the real coal miner. And then we built set pieces in Atlanta, Georgia, and dressed our actors up in those same costumes. So when you see the front of it, it's them. But when you see them from the back, it's the real coal miners.
Oh, and wow.
And then just built set pieces, drop foam on them and stuff like that.
Yeah. Ow.
Yeah, totally. Sometimes it was bouncing. It's pretty funny whenever you're editing.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, exactly. You're editing like, ooh, that didn't go that way. It's like when they use miniatures in water, like I'm watching The Lord of the Rings right now over like Christmas break, and like the miniatures with the water, it's like you just can't get water to be smaller, right? So like when it bubbles through and like big splashes and you're like, that's not what that should look like. That splash is way too big. That piece of water coming off of there just took out a whole house, and it should just be a splash bubble, you know, like it should be a mist, and it just doesn't work. But yeah, it's like, I don't think people notice that stuff though. Like you do, and we do in home theater. You watch a movie enough, you'd be like, oh yeah, that's foam. Look at the way. But when you're first into it, you must know, it's like it plays so well because you're just so into it and you're so captivated by the movie that you're like, you're not looking at like foam bouncing off of them or something.
Yeah, I always look at it like my parents' test. I could shoot something on film with the greatest VFX or shoot it on a video camera with minimal effects. They don't know the difference. They're going to be into it or not. And, you know.
Yeah, and it's, I say that to my wife, like, coming into the house, and she, the house is a mess. Look at this. Oh, my floor's a scratch. I'm like, people walk in and they don't see the little tiny details that we live with every day, right? You got a little paint chip on the wall and it's like, nobody sees that. They just see the overall look, right? And when you're shooting stuff like this, do you take that into account? Do you like, okay, we're going to ignore that, trick the viewer. We don't care. We like, literally, are you thinking like, I think of the one in, Star Wars when if you Empire Strikes Back and you look at them in the speeders at the opening when they're going underneath the walkers, and they literally have bubble wrap taped to their harnesses just for texture. And if it like now in 4K, you can actually see the cuts. Like, you know, when you cut bubble wrap, it's not a perfect cut and you can see the scissors. Like, you could see it's like not a square cut. It's just put on there. And the effects or the costume department is like, we need something more on these harnesses to make them look futuristic. I got this bubble wrap here. What do you think? Yeah, nobody will know the difference. Perfect. And then in the future, you're like, oh crap, now we see the difference. But that's what makes it fun. Now, do you like think, like you said, you did foam. Do you think of anything like that?
Constantly. Yeah, that's the name of the game. I mean, is how meticulous can you be? And it really, no matter how meticulous you are, you always screw up. And look at like a movie like Empire Strikes Back. If they screw up, then what does the other filmmakers of the world do?
Yeah.
You know, who doesn't have that type of financing and support? You know, it's tough.
Well, yeah, it is. But that's where the best ideas come from, though. Like, I think it was it Rob Cohn did Hurricane Heist?
Yeah.
Is that the one we talk about? Yeah. And John, did you tell me about that one?
Yeah, the documentary on it. Yeah.
Yeah. And like I watched all the extras and the documentary and stuff. And he was like, he's used to doing Fast and the Furious, right? And all these movies that you have a huge budget on. And he's like, oh, for this shot, I need 3 cranes so I can get this. And then he like calls the studio and he's like, I need 2 cranes. And he didn't have one. And they're like, you're not getting, all right, I'll just take the one. You're not getting that either. And he's like, oh, all right. And he even says, he goes, I came up with a different way of doing it, a more creative way. Like, that's how invention is created. That's how things are invented, out of necessity, you know? And it's like, you throw money at anything to solve the problem, but you don't get creative. And in our level of the world, it's like, how do I make this look like a big budget film? Or how do I make my theater look like a big budget theater? And yet I put it together with, you know, bubble gum and duct tape. Yeah. It's like, don't sit down too quick. The chairs will collapse.
Tell them about Martin's, what Martin lost during the filming of Mine 9.
So my brother-in-law let us borrow 4 wetsuits for the actors. Yeah. And I didn't know. I wasn't in the water, or I wasn't wearing the wetsuit with them. So somebody in the costume department had a smart idea so they could go to the bathroom to cut the ass out of the water suit. And I did not examine these water suits. So they cut the ass out and they wore them. And then I just put them back in a box and I shipped them back to Martin. Like, that's it. And Martin drove. He's in Florida and there's never any surf. So he had to drive like an hour, hour and a half to go surfing one day on this cold ass morning. And went to pulled out his wetsuit to put it on, and the ass was cut out of it.
Oh, jeez!
So he was perturbed, to say the least.
Yeah, that kind of gets chilly.
Yeah,
he turned a wetsuit into chaps. For all intents and
purposes, exactly what it was.
Was it because the actors had to spend time in water to keep him somewhat warm? Is that what it was for a scene?
Yeah, because we filmed in the middle of, like, I think it was February, January. It was freezing in Atlanta. I mean, freezing. And so the water, you know, you get hypothermia. You had to. I mean, we had to heat the water. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Was that for the actors or the crew?
It was for the actors. And one the DP and the actors. It was for the water scene when it came in through the door.
Right, right. Yeah. When it started. Oof.
It was like a pool. It was like a real water tank we built. We got I don't know what we had. We built it with wood and then put rubber and then like put rubber cement over top of it and literally made a pool.
Oh man.
Then we had a big bucket. We dumped it from up top, which was pretty cool.
How many gallons is that? Cause that was a crazy scene.
It was a lot of gallons. I mean, we saw something on The Hobbit behind the scenes where I've never even watched the Hobbit movie, but I was watching the behind the scenes where somebody's floating down the water and then everywhere, like on the left and right side of the screen, that it's got these buckets on like a spindle type of thing. And it just like dumps the water. And, so we built one of those.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
How much of the movie is prep? and money spent on all of those scenes, all of that time. And then I feel like it's like Thanksgiving dinner, only like a thousandfold, because you spend all that time and energy prepping for a scene and you're like, got it, on to the next scene. And it's like, you know what I mean? Like all that work to do that.
We prep for a year before we spend any money, like just doing it on our own schedules. And we shot for 15 days and it was over. So it was quite depressing, to be honest with you, to work that hard building all those sets. And you only get 15 days to make it. And then, you know, you got to tear it all down.
Don't mind me. I'm just adjusting the height of my desk here. Just stand up, sit down, as I do in the 24-hour show. But my back gets going. nice little segue there. You watch my backdrop go, wee. Yeah. So like what now, directing, organizing all, I've been dying to talk to you about this because I'm like John said, like I'm GC on a house right now and I'm horrible at it. This has got to be insane. Like organizing all the people. How do you, what, walk through that a bit. I'd love to hear like what it's like organizing from everything, the actors, the people, where you're shooting, who's doing what, what's going on, and how stressful is that?
It's not stressful. It's sort of fun, you know? I like the organizing part. Like I think in another way, I'd like to be a location scout. I love finding locations. Like that's the best part. So that's really, like for the little movies I make, these Appalachian movies, you got to find your locations you got to find accommodations first, because you can find the greatest location in a small little town. But if there's no hotel nearby, nobody's staying there. And you're not driving an hour to work every day from some city. So it's really just finding the appropriate locations, making sure there's accommodations nearby. And, just really hammering out like the look and the wardrobe and the design of it all. Yeah. And, then casting is the best part. Like, you know,
that's here, all ahead of time, right? Like you do all of that, like well ahead of time.
Yeah. And like, usually like they'll do auditions. You get to see a bunch of different people doing auditions and, you know, you start to, you know, make a short list and then hire who you want.
Yeah.
So that's always a fun part too. All this is done way in advance.
Yeah. So do you do all of your own casting or do you hire and then, but then when you hire somebody, do you get final say or do you go with their word? How does that work?
A casting director, you hire a casting director to cast for you and he or she is there to serve what you want.
Okay.
You know, they're trying to get the best cast for you. They don't have any say in it.
Oh, okay. So how did, like, for instance, like this one where you have, what's her name? Bacon's daughter.
Sosie Bacon.
I was going to say Sophia, but Sosie Bacon. So do you give a description and then she just happens to fill that description or like, how did that work?
Well, for this one, I hired Alex Rowe, the lead, first. And he's friends with Sosie, and he became a producer on the show. And we were just trying to, like, we had a short list of people who we wanted, and he just thought she'd be good for it, and he just called her up, and she was into it. So that's how she got cast.
Oh, but nice. It was
her relationship with Alex.
Oh, okay. All right, that's cool. So does that happen a lot? Like, relationships end up meaning, like, push in, and then the role goes around that person?
It's sort of like in a smaller sense when you see like Tarantino and those people, they work with the same actors all the time. So I think relationships are everything.
Yeah, I could see that. I've heard that like relationships with a director are important because it's like they know what each other wants, right? They're easier to work with than when you bring in a newer actor that you're like, oh, they're not giving me what I want. And it's harder to work with them.
Or they're just jerks.
I've heard that. I'm not asking you to name any names.
It can be crew members or anything. It can just be like anybody. We could all start working together today and there's 50 of us. Probably one or two of us suck.
Yeah. Well, and that was the other thing is like as a director, as the artist, as the writer, director, all of this, how much compromise do you give to an actor or any of the, any like, we can get into sound in a little bit because I really want to talk about that. But when you're talking with an actor and they have their idea on the role, like how much compromise do you give? Do you just, or not?
I write it and I hire the right actor and then I shut up and it's their role at that point. So I'm only just to guide them from point A to point B. Now, if they came in acting like an idiot, you know what I mean? Right. Like totally wrong, you can say that. But if you hire the right person, they're not going to do that. And they do enough prep, you know, you're on the same page no matter what. But it's not my job to tell the actor exactly how to do something. Like I want them to do it and bring something to the table.
Oh, nice. So when they win awards and stuff, they're legitimately, for the most part, are doing exactly what they wanted under, you know, because a lot of people are like, well, hey, they weren't very good in this, but maybe that's what the director told them to do. Or maybe, you know what I mean? Like, do you understand what I'm saying? Like what people say with stuff like that?
Yeah, I don't know. I only know from my experience that I really like casting, because if you cast the right person, they're going to do service to the job. They're going to care for it.
Right.
But yeah, I assume like if you're making a studio TV show or movie, they probably have a lot less say so, because a lot of the executive producers probably, you know, put their foot down. But, you know, I want the actor to shine. So probably the less I say, the better they'll do.
Yeah, but there's got to be stuff where, like, you wrote these, right?
Yep.
And so you have these characters, if for lack of a better term, especially with Hazard. I wouldn't really call these characters, but I guess they are. But these personalities, is there any, like, are there times when you're trying to get them to emote something that it's just, like, when you were writing it, it's not what you were thinking? Like, they're not doing it right?
No, like I always say, there's a movie you write, there's a movie you make, and there's a movie you edit. And they're all different. Like, for Hazard, I storyboarded every frame of the movie. And it's a drama with not a lot of effects or anything, so I certainly did not need to do that, but I did it just to do it. But then you actually get on set, and everything changes. Your storyboards sort of go out the window.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I always look at it like, as soon as you start seeing an actor do, maybe after the first day or two, you fully realize it's not the character you wrote anymore. It's their character. And it's your job to, you know, provide them any assistance they need to continue on with that character.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard it put that way, right? Like, I've always heard like, oh, the director wanted this and how it moves like that. But that's interesting. Like you give them kind of an outline and let them run with it from there. And then they make that character their own. I'm sure if they went way off skew, you pull them back, you reel them back in. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. But I mean, really, if you do your job as a writer and you do your job casting, that won't happen because everybody's already on the same page, you know?
Right. Yeah. That's awesome. My nine, any challenges acting wise that you had with people? Like you said, you were shooting actual minors and then, you know, face shots were actors that aren't minors. And how was that? Like
directing my nine was totally different than Hazard. My nine was easy because those dudes, it's like making a war movie, probably. Like they all supported one another and they were all hanging out constantly. And like due to the logistics of the set, like when it's 2 foot taller and they're laying under a bunch of foam and stuff and there's sound people, I would always be like maybe 20 yards away. And so it's hard to direct somebody from 20 yards away sometimes. So all the actors really sort of protected one another. So it was easy. Like they just sort of were in it.
Oh, that's good. That's, yeah. It's a hard movie to watch, as I'm sure Hazard will be too. What was it like on set with like Mine 9? Was there fun? Even though you're shooting these hard scenes, was there any kind of like joking around and stuff in some of those harder scenes just to keep the crew like light?
Yeah, those dudes were total jackasses. I mean, they all kept it light by themselves. Yeah, like in a good way. Like they all were being goofy the whole time. So
yeah,
not me. Funny. I had too much going on, but it was. It's sort of nice. Like they took care of themselves a lot of the way.
Yeah, yeah, that's good.
They all took on the responsibilities of their characters too. Like Zeke was the leader, and he sort of was the leader on set. You know, yeah. Drew was a young kid, and you know, like everybody filled a role. You know.
Oh, nice. That's cool. Sound. What is it when you get into the editing? We'll talk picture in a little bit too. But what is it like? Like you did Mine 9 and 5-1. Do you have any say on that? Or is it like you do with the actors? Do you let the sound department just like, how does that mix?
No, I'm fully engulfed in sound. Like,
so you anything- are into home theater.
No, yeah, I mean, I don't have a home theater.
Ask him what his home theater is and you'll see.
My laptop. We don't have
TV. Yeah, John told me that. John told me that.
We don't have a TV in the house.
Yeah, you edit the movie on a laptop, he said.
Yeah, and well, I have a couple big monitors, but yeah. But sound, I love sound. And I always knew the sounds of like every, I only go for like real sounds. So like, Michael, the sound editor on the movie, like he's in LA. So like he would like go to like the canyons in LA and like record dripping water and get like canyon sounds. And I actually flew him to Virginia and we went underground in a coal mine and he filmed all the organic sounds. So like even the score, which a guy named Mauricio Yazighi did, it was taking those real sounds from the coal mine and putting them into more of musical sounds, but not score, like dun 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 dun, that type of stuff. And I think we did the same thing with Hazard.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was gonna say, what, so like I've seen Mine 9, haven't seen Hazard. I was gonna say, like, what's the sound like on that? I mean, this is more of a drama, obviously, not a, you know, Mine 9 had an action to it.
It's a drama. It's a drama, but there really is, in my heart, there's an action just like Mine 9, because it's a guy going through the final stages of addiction. Like he gets to become as sick as addiction can make you become before you're going to give in or go into rehab and just give up. So we really try to put the sounds and the story and the camera and everything from Will's point of view. So hopefully that's just as claustrophobic as the coal mine. And just as like hard to watch, and you know, that's his addiction is the coal mine for this one.
Oh, okay. So what that then? What was your motivation for Hazard? Is it personal? Is it, I mean, just the what you've seen, like publicly and everything like that? With
it was the first script that I ever wrote years ago, and it wasn't like a big thing, like Hulu, like none of these people had made any of, you know, the Dope Sick and all the different shows about opioid addiction. I wrote mine way before any of these people, but I could never get it made because it wasn't in the news enough. And I wrote it off one of my best friend's brother, who has the disease. So I got to go back with him to Hazard where he was living at the time or from. And, just got to dive in and try to figure out what the story of addiction is. So it came from a personal thing. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's, and I mean, cause it is, it's a tough subject. It's, I mean, obviously timely. And how long ago did you write it?
I'm going to age myself, but it was the first script I ever wrote and it was 2003.
Wow. So, and it
It just sat on the shelf for years, and I've written several things since it. But it just sat on the shelf, and then I left, you know, I just wanted to make it. So that was it.
So I'm obviously you're happy with it?
Yeah, I love it. I'm excited. Yeah, yeah, I'm very happy with it. I got to do all the drama stuff that I didn't get to do. We wrote it in Mine 9. Mine 9 was like a 110-page script, and we only got to film 72 pages of it because of budget. So, like, there's a whole world outside of the mine in the movie. We just didn't get to film it.
Right. So that's interesting.
I got to film it with this one. I said, let's not technically shoot ourselves in the foot by a coal mine so we can actually just do all the drama stuff we didn't get to do in that one.
Yeah. So if you ever got the opportunity, would you ever do more? of either of those, like of my nine, would you go back and do, like, if it, if the opportunity arose, would you do all those other, like, remake it?
I would remake it into a TV series, like 24. Like, oh, wow. What happens when a coal mine explodes above ground and below ground? I have a whole idea to do it at some point.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. Like a TV series, like a Netflix type thing.
Yeah, right? Like an eight-part series.
Yeah, like an yeah, exactly. And do it like 24 as in like hourly, like by the minute.
Yeah, because right? That's what happens. Like when something explodes, you know, the clock's ticking. And there's a lot of protocol on the outside about how do you even do a rescue. You know, the family, the friends, all that kind of stuff, you know. And plus, like, really diving deeper into, like, the proper protocol that miners would do down below.
Yeah. How did you get into that?
Coal mining?
Yeah.
I just thought it was a cool idea for a movie. I just remember when we were kids, like when Johnny and I were kids and like there'd be like the Sega mine accident or something. Like, you know, people would stare at it's like when Baby Jessica fell in the well. You know, people would like, they would be on the news and it would, so people would watch it on the news. So it was sort of a big thing. And I just always thought nine miners, 2 miles under the earth, 1 hour of oxygen, you know, sort of a no-brainer.
Wow. So how, like, your research on that, how long did that take you? Because I felt like watching that movie, I felt like you had personal experience or something, like you knew something, like, because it's just so, I mean, I hate to use the term, in-depth.
The only thing I am is extremely claustrophobic, so I think maybe I did a good job because of that. But I am the furthest thing from a coal miner. I'm
Well, being claustrophobic, that would be tough.
Yeah, but one of my best friends was working in the coal industry at the time and had a pretty great position and gave me access to everything. Like, it's tough to, like, go to a real coal mine, and we had, like, a real man trip, the machinery and stuff. So
yeah,
it's quite tough to find that stuff.
Oh, cool. But, it translates for sure. Like, I mean, like I said, it seems like you've known it your whole life or something, and you just made a move. Like, that's why. How did you nail that? How did you get all that so accurate? And I don't know. Maybe part of it is also it's so up close.
Right? Yeah. Well,
like in those mines, and that when everything actually happens, it's scary. And it translates real well. Like I said earlier, like in a dedicated theater, you're like you're holding your breath.
Cool. Well, I appreciate it. But no, I can't mine coal.
Well,
I want to say something. Whenever, we had a guy that worked for us and he left us to go work in the coal mine. And, he said when they did their safety training, I said, well, don't let your mom watch Mine 9 because his mom was a nervous wreck because he's in the coal mine. But when they did their safety training, when they were done for the day, it was like a week or 2 weeks long safety training. Their instructor showed Mine 9 to all the people that were becoming coal miners, which I thought was insane.
Is that safety training, or if they don't bail out after seeing that, you know, you have a coal miner.
Maybe trying to weed people out. I don't know.
Exactly. That's that speech. Like, look around you. The people sitting next to you won't be there. It's okay. Like that's crazy. That's crazy. But, picture when you're shooting this and like we're big into like, and I mean, obviously in home theater, we're big into the picture, big into the sound, all of that. It's like when you're shooting this, what is it like for like your cinematography, how you're the composition of the shot, how you set that up, what you're looking for, how much of that is like you said, like storyboard is like that crap goes out the window because now you're here and it's like maybe the lighting's different. How in depth is that?
Well, the cinematographer, he knows exactly what you want, and then he's going to tell you what's possible. He or she's going to say, well, how about something like this? Like, you know, like, let's say I wanted the camera to fly into the room, and we don't even have the tools to do such a thing. He would, you know, tell me an option, you know, that could project the same emotion. But really, like, my DP and I are, you know, like, he doesn't communicate to the actors well, but he communicates to myself well. Like, he's sort of like, he's your best friend in it, I guess. Like, it's just you and somebody picking the best shots.
Yeah. Yeah, so, like, but, like, for instance, when you get in a tight shot, like, in my nine, down on it, and it's a still shot, like, the composition of the shot, the angle they're looking, all of that, and then the lighting, it's, like, how much of that is decided in the moment, how much of that is, like, ahead of time, you know, like, all right, we want them from this side, looking this way. I got a rudimentary version of this from just being in art class. It's, like, if you put them, like, on screen and they're looking this way, if they're this far, it looks like they're traveling faster. If they're looking from here, you see what I mean? Like, this is audio only, so people don't see what I'm saying. But, like, depending on how you shoot it, how you can change the emotion just by where you put their face on the screen.
Yeah, and absolutely. Like, yeah. Absolutely.
And how much of that is, like, decided ahead of time, and then you get there and go, that's not what I'm looking for.
That happens. Absolutely, that happens. But you always have, like, you know what the story is, like what you need to achieve in each scene. So you have your two or three shots you need to achieve that emotion in the scene. So that's always there. But what happens when you get to set, you're always running against the clock. Like, yeah. You know, you have an hour and a half to get the scene done. So you sort of have to pick your battles. So, like, if there's an overhead shot that might take a little time to set up, you'll just have to say, I might not get this other shot, but what's more important to get, the overhead shot or something else? So, really, you have, you know, your wish list, but, you know, you have to pick what's most important.
Really? So, like, any shots you wish you got, like, I've seen my nine, any shots you wish you got there that you never got?
Oh, man. I didn't get any shot that I wanted.
It still came out great.
Yeah, I mean, we picked what's enough to have finished the scene. When you only got 15 days, you sort of have to pick your battles.
15 days you shot that.
Yeah, I wish Peter Berg makes the Hollywood bigger budget version of everything I want to do. So he would be a good guest to tell you what it's like to have everything you want to make these type of movies.
Oh, I just keep going back to how complicated the whole thing is. And you're like, it's fun. It's just organizing everybody like that. It's like, so my night, was that your first?
Second.
What was your first?
It's called The Deposition. And Johnny, were you in it? I made it with all family and friends back home.
Briefly, yeah. Yeah. That was shot in our hometown with some local talent and a few friends of his. But the one guy wasn't.
It was super low budget. I really did it just to make a full length film and just to say, okay, I did it, you know?
Yeah.
And that was really, I mean, I don't know about the quality of the film, but it was a great thing just to get that monkey off your back and say, okay, now that I did it, now I can do it again 6 years later properly.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, when you get it, like the first one, it's got to be daunting, like overwhelming even, right? Like all the things that you have to do, it's on the first time and you're like, am I going to be able to like organize this? And then once you get an idea for what it is it like Mine 9 was easier? Was even Hazard easier than Mine 9?
Hazard was the easiest. The Deposition would have failed worse than it probably did, but we were back home. So like if we were running late, you would just tell my grandma to open up her basement, you know, or wherever we filmed that, we could get access to it 24 hours a day. So that was just organized chaos, I guess. My nine was just so technically difficult. There was nothing fun about doing it in 15 days. It sort of sucked. Hazard was amazing. Like we could have, it was 15 days, but we had a COVID breakout. It was a false positive is what they're called. So we got shut down for a day, almost a full day. And then there was two lightning strikes that shut us down for about 3-4 hours each day. So we really didn't even have 15 days. So if we weren't chasing the clock, it would have been easy, you know, a lot easier than it was.
Yeah. So,
but Hazard was great. There was no technical effects, just light.
Whoop.
He's back.
Yeah, I lost him for a sec. Yeah, yeah. Oh, ah, damn. Nah. No, just like what it's like organizing was the first easier, like obviously as they go, it gets easier to do them because you get more of a feel. And you were saying, Hazard was the easiest because there's no technical effects. It was more just a shoot, right? And stuff like that. So what about like editing and stuff? Obviously that's where, like, you shoot something in 15 days, the movie isn't done in like 3 weeks.
No, it's like you edit. It's like you edit and walk away, but it takes them like 7-8 months, really.
Yeah. So
it's thankless, and I don't want to. It's thankless like that. I edit my films, and that's the one thing I can certainly see not doing in the future.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my eyes hurt. My eyes hurt, and it's just tough staring at a screen. It's like Groundhog's Day for like 8 months.
Yeah, it's. I hate to sound like this guy, you know, having you on making actual movies, but I'm like, I edit podcasts and it kills me. It's like I'm doing stupid, like 1 hour long podcasts. And the reason I'm on the computer I'm on now is I did like 4 hours of editing and my computer died and I lost all 4 hours.
Oh,
that sucks. So my question out of that is, is there editing in the flow similar to when you're shooting it? Cause I do it like when I was doing these edits for like these home theater tours, I'd have ideas like right in the middle on how I'm going to move through the shot. And then when you lose the info, like I lost it all, right? Now I got to go back and do it again. In my head, I'm not as it's off the cuff. Now I'm trying to remember, how did I think this shot was going to go? Because I'm doing it. I'm like, oh, this looks nice. We're talking about this part of his theater, and I'm going to move through the shot like this, and I'm going to move the camera down like that because I'm all editing. I'm moving it all in post, right? When you got to do it a second time, I'm like, it was so good the first time. How do I duplicate that? And it's hard to do. I'm not saying you've lost your stuff, but is there stuff that you, after the fact, you're like, oh, I can move this way, and I have this. Have you ever done reshoots? Is it because when you're in editing, you want to do something like, oh my God, I just got an idea. Can we throw this in now? Anything like that?
I'd love to. That'd be amazing. That doesn't really happen in an independent film. You sort of get what you can and everybody goes home and, you know, everybody goes on with their life. If it was a studio movie, you'd do reshoots left and right, you know, but yeah. We do not have that luxury. Which is fine. Like, you know, like it goes back to your point about being creative earlier. Okay, you don't get to do a reshoot, but you got to figure it out. You can't just let it not be figured out. So no matter how daunting it is, and I've lost stuff too before, or you edited something that felt good the night before and it didn't feel good, but you guys got to, you got to figure it out. There's no other choice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, well, like you said, it's like you're handcuffed by a situation, but you make the best of it. So you get the shot that you want it to begin with, and then you're working with it, and maybe you get an idea and it would be great to have a reshoot here, but I don't. But at least, but just by your response, it's like you get the idea of why they do reshoot. Oh my God, this would be great if I just had this one shot and I could add this to it. And I hear people say all the time, like, oh, they did reshoots on this movie, it means it's horrible. Doesn't always mean that in my head. I think it's like, maybe they just got a new creative idea after the fact and they're like, oh, they saw something. It doesn't always mean, in my opinion, it doesn't always mean that something was wrong with the original shoot. It could be, I can add this into the original shot. And I think it means that much more. It evokes a different emotion or something like that.
Sure. And like a lot of bigger movies, they do test screenings. So the studio might test it with various audiences and get feedback from that. And once they get feedback, they could say, well, we want to go back and reshoot and do X, Y, and Z. So, I mean, you can do it or not do it
Yeah.
It's, you still got to figure it out, I guess.
Yeah.
It's a luxury.
Yeah, it is a luxury, but it also, I don't know. Do you think it gets used as a crutch? Like they don't necessarily, like you said, it's a luxury. So maybe on the first shoot, they're like, oh, we'll get it. If we don't get it, we'll come back.
I bet you some people get to say that.
Yeah. Is it, you don't.
No, not at all. I remember I bring up Peter Berg again. I forget what movie he was making. And they're in, that was Michael Bay. Like all they were doing is doing like the entire day was just one explosion, like a car wrecking or something. I'm like,
yeah,
that'd be amazing to show up to work and be like, this is the only thing you have to do today is this one thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, how long did Hazard take to shoot?
15 days.
That was 15 days too?
Yeah.
Both of them?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's just like a good sweet spot. You know, once you get into 20 days, by the time people come, it's more than a month. So like your budget starts going up as soon as you hit that 20 day mark. And 20 days would be great, but there's a lot of weekends off that you still got to take care of people, you know, like when you're not filming, and that stuff gets really costly quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, well, yeah, everything's on time and,
you can pay people a fair wage, but nothing spectacular, and you can take them away from their families to remote places in Virginia and Tennessee and Kentucky, but you're not going to do it for more than 15, 20 days.
Right. Yeah. <It's> like, hey, you want to come out and hang out in a mine for 15 days?
Yeah.
How about 30? Nope. I'll go for 15.
We'll go for 15. Yeah. It's
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And is there any part of that that makes it even a little bit easier, knowing it's only, like you said, the sweet spot. Like, all right, we just got to press hard for 15 days.
Yeah, absolutely. Done. It makes it easy for me because you just know, you know exactly what you're going to do and you know exactly how you're going to get it. And there's not a lot of guessing. By the time people show up to set, it's the only time you start spending money. Everything else is just time, your time. So the more organized you are, by the time you show up, you should be able to accomplish it.
Yeah, that's cool. John, how much pressure are you putting on him for home theater?
Oh, it's done. I mean, he's been over to my house. It hasn't swayed him a bit. He doesn't have a TV, so I don't think a home theater is in his cards anytime soon.
Not at all, Eddie?
Someday, maybe.
A screening room for yourself?
That'd be cool, but we have a 9-year-old son who's really on screens, and my wife makes art as well. She's on screens. So like sitting around the TV when we're done for the day, watching screens is not, you know, how we see us raising our child, I guess.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I never even thought of it from that perspective. Like the mechanic with the crappy car. Like I work on cars all day. I just want something to get me back and forth to work. I'm not, you know, that crazy about it. And it's like you do it all day and just to be like, now I'm going to sit down in my theater.
Yeah. I still like going to movie theaters. So I still love going to the theater, and we got a lot of good ones in Atlanta. So
what's your favorite so far this year?
Anora.
Anora?
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't seen that one yet.
What's that?
Sean Baker's his name. He made Tangerine, Florida Project. It won the Cannes Film Festival. It's pretty great. I heard Nosferatu is really good.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet. I haven't heard it. I actually haven't heard it. It just came out, what, 2 days ago?
Yeah.
I think, yeah, came out Christmas Day. So, yeah, I haven't heard anything about it. But you hearing good things about it?
Yeah, I hear it's great.
Awesome.
What about you guys? What's your else favorite movies?
Go ahead, John. This year?
This year.
Gosh, I don't know. There hasn't been a lot of really good ones. I mean, that I've seen, I can't think of anything off the top of my head that was gangbusters great.
Yeah, there's, well, mine, the one that pops in my head, it isn't even home theater. Just, I don't know why. Fall Guy. I just had so much fun with that one. Action, comedy, you know, like, romantic comedy, if you want to call it that. But it had enough action in it, and it was, you know, call back to the original, the TV show, Fall Guy. Love that. And it, just a lot of fun for that one. But then we get into, like, well, Civil War.
No, I like Civil War. That was this year. I did like that.
Civil War was really good. There's just, I mean, why is my mind's going blank too? Cause I'm just getting overwhelmed because I'm trying to put my list together for the end of the year. And I'm like, I'm trying to think what was the one we talked about just the other day? We talked about something just the other day, but I'm also liking, like, well, just to get to it, I also like the stuff that they're redoing with, like, Twister. We talked about that, the remakes of Twister, new audio, the new video, you know, the upscale video, up converted to 4K and everything, remastered, everything like that. But what the heck is it? Oh my God, my mind's going blank too. People are yelling at us right now, John. Like, what the hell?
I remember when Johnny showed me the remastered Escape from New York Blu-ray. It was like they shot it that year. It was so good.
Oh yeah. That's what we said about Twister. And Twister coming out this year, we're like, that was the movie, and what made it so big is that one came out in what? It was like 93, I think, something like that, in the theaters or whatever. Maybe it was after that. I know Jurassic Park was 93.
It was like 99, wasn't it? Twister? Maybe?
No, it was before that because it was one of the first Blu-ray DVDs or something like that, I think it was. Or maybe it was the first. Maybe it was one of the first.
It was the first flipper disc, Warner Brothers. Yeah. It was the first DVD commercial.
Yeah. That was the one when they came out with Atmos or any sound, everybody wanted to hear that one in Atmos and have that up converted from the 5.1 that we always had. Like I had on Laserdisc, and then you end up on DVD, and then you get the Blu-ray, and it was always, that was the one. And then when it finally came out this year, there was a German, it was German, right, John?
Turbine, yeah.
A German Blu-ray that had an Atmos track for Twister. And then we thought that was great. And then they actually, the studio put out a completely remastered video and audio. Everything's redone. And it just blew it away. It was like, it was made this year. And it actually made it better than, like, the Twister is better than Twisters, which came out this year.
Yeah.
For audio and video. It's, I mean, Twisters was fun. Yeah. Yeah. So that was a lot of fun.
Tell them about what made you want to go to film school. Cause
hey,
I really don't understand it.
Hey, before that, we mixed Hazard in 5.1, and our sound mixer who works, I think it's Warner Brothers, said that everybody's doing 5.1 again and not Atmos.
What?
Well, that's the Nolan thing. Nolan loves 5.1.
That it's really negligible, and a lot of people are going back to 5.1. And I don't have a clue. I'm just remembering what he said to me.
Huh.
Yeah, it's... Well, you can...
The group that watches it at home, it's like 1% of the people have a real Atmos system.
I think that's exactly what he was talking about, is that such a small amount of people that even have can do it.
Right. Well, that's the problem. And it's like... And in this community, we're all like... Why aren't they giving us more? It's like, cause there's only a handful of us in the world. And it's like when you mix any of this stuff, it's like, and I say it all the time. It's like on the Apollo 13 extras, you hear Ron Howard say, like, we mixed this for the home theater group. And I'm like, he's talking to us. It's like, it's cause nobody appreciates the sound like we do. Right. Like how many people are watching My Nine, Eddie included, on their laptops. And, you know, and not putting it into an actual home theater and getting to experience the claustrophobia and everything on a big screen and the sound, because the sound plays a part of that, because you're hearing stuff all around you and it's the room crumbling or the echoes or whatever. And it's like all of that plays in. And Atmos is, you can get the same effect with 5.1 that you get with Atmos. Just look at Christopher Nolan. In all his film, he doesn't use object based. He uses 5.1, and same with Tarantino. same way. So, but yeah, it's as far as, oh, the other one, John, have you seen Dune?
Oh, yeah, I like Dune. I liked it.
Dune 2 this year. Yeah, obviously that one just popped in my head. Yeah,
I like
it. Yeah, this, I mean, tons and tons of movies this year, but I'm, but again, like you said, it's like nothing really, I mean, we had Dune 2, we have, like I just said, with Civil War was a big one, but we did just have one a couple of weeks ago, and I can't believe I'm going blank on it.
Gladiator 2? I don't know. It was okay.
I just saw that. I haven't, I'll be talking about it next week. I just saw it at home, and that was really good. I really enjoyed it.
I liked it. Yeah. It wasn't nearly as good as the first one, though.
No, but I like the story.
Yeah.
I like how they incorporated the story into it. I don't know about home theater wise. I thought it was good, but I wasn't, it's not really a ton that blew me away with that. So, but yeah, so, John, yeah. Eddie, what are you doing? What's next for you?
I'm going to do a project for a company. It's a faith-based project that, so that's going to happen this coming year. And, then I want to make another one of mine, and it's, called Rednecks, and it's about, early 1900s battle of Blair Mountain when 10,000 coal miners band together to battle like 2,000 company gun thugs, on Blair Mountain. It's sort of, the unionization of coal miners in Appalachia.
You've been kicking that around for a while too.
Yeah. I've just wanted to make some things ahead of time it's a war movie to like be able to shoot a war movie. You don't really just say, I'm going to go make a war movie.
Yeah. Not at the outset.
Yeah.
All right. My first movie. Yeah. Line them up. Yeah. That's now, are you going to shoot that in 15 days?
No, not at all. It will have a much better budget. And the faith-based thing I'm doing is like real heavy in VFX. It's actually quite violent in a lot of sense. And, I'm doing that in preparation, to make Rednecks. So besides getting paid to do someone else's project, it's going to really help me prep for mine because it'll be the most VFX heavy project that I've done. Nine had a ton of VFX, but I think Rednecks will have a ton more.
So like when you say VFX on Mine 9, other than the foam, which isn't that, do you consider that visual effects?
Yeah, because just, every time it bounces, you have to make it not bounce. So you got to like rotoscope that rock so it looks like it falls and not bounces. If there's paint chipped, you know, and the camera's moving, you have to color every single frame of the paint chip. You have to add smoke. You have to add debris. You know, there's a million things you're doing to it.
Oh, wow. Wow. I didn't even think of all that stuff. Like every little tiny piece is like, yeah.
Tell them what your wife had to do even with the deposition on the scene at the lake or whatever.
Well, in my first film, our family friend, farmer guy, let us go film at his little hunting camp, and he had a lake and a little dock. And he only said we could go there for like 3 or 4 days, and we were running late, and we were there 5 or 6 days. And by the seventh day, I don't know what the hell he did. He was going to do it anyways, but he raised the dock like 5 feet out of the water and, made it higher. So we had all these dock scenes to shoot. So half the damn movie, there was a dock floating in the water. And the other half of the movie, the dock is 4 feet above the water. So my wife had to like literally cut the poles off and raise the water and make everything match.
His wife's a graphic artist type person. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, she hated it. She does not like the film industry, but you know, she'll do stuff for me. But,
every frame she had to go in and
it was horrible. I mean, it was horrible.
Yeah. And because every frame. What is it? 30 frames a second? 24 frames a second. So, yeah. And they all have to match.
Yeah. It was, you know.
I love Eddie. yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was horrible. I remember showing up that day and I'm like, what the hell happened? The dock's 4 feet above the water right now.
Yeah. The one thing that you think would be in that same spot.
Yeah. Like, right.
Wait a minute. The dock moved. Oh my God. So all right. 24 frames a second. How many seconds was that on camera?
I bet it was minutes, you know, 8 minutes, 6 minutes or something like that. I mean, maybe probably about 6 minutes, I would say. I mean, there were scenes on the dock that you already shot half the scene with it, so you had to go back and finish it. So there was no changing locations.
Oh my God. Oh my God. It's just, that's painstaking.
Yeah, it was painstaking.
It is.
Good family friend.
Yeah. Yeah. Holy cow. That's insane. That's tedious work. That's, oh man. So how long now? So Rednecks you're doing next. So the one you're doing first, that'll take this year, right? You were saying?
Yeah. I mean, we're just sort of
2025
agreeing to stuff. So I don't think Rednecks will happen for another year and a half or something like that. If it, you know,
to start it.
Yeah. Just to start it. Yeah.
And then once you get going on it,
it's going through a bigger production company. So really you're just at the mercy of them.
Yeah. Yeah, because this, I mean, you're looking at, you know, Hazard. I mean, John and I have been talking about it for like 4 years. And he was like talking about you coming on the show. I'm like, oh, this is going to be great and everything. And it was like 4 years. Do you think Rednecks will take that long once you get started?
No, not at all. I mean, Hazard didn't take 4 years. We shot it in mid-2022. And it wrapped up mid-2024. So it was about a 2-year process. And now we got to release it. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think John mentioned it to me before you started shooting. He's like, you're starting this movie here because I had seen Mine 9. We were talking about that. And then he was like, oh, my brother's doing this one, but I know you are really busy with that and everything leading up to it. And then it's like, having you on the show and organizing this and you were busy. So and here we are.
We also got hammered by COVID. Like COVID shut down everything for a long time. So we were supposed to start Hazard before COVID and then that shut down. And then the strike didn't do us any favors in post-production.
Oh, wow. So you're doing the editing. Well, how did the strike affect you? You couldn't work?
Voiceover? I could. If you want your actors to come in and do ADR, like if a line's messed up for some reason, which that stuff happens, they were not allowed to come in and do the ADR. So we couldn't like progress and mix the movie and finish all the sound, until the strike was over, which sucked.
Oh, yeah. Now does that hit your budget? Does that, or just delay everything on you?
Delays everything on you. Yeah. Ugh. It doesn't affect the budget because you're not spending it. You're not doing anything with it. It's just sitting there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I just didn't know if it was like, oh, okay, got to wait on this. So it's going to cost me more money because something else is going on.
Like we were already paying sound people like to do the ADR and to do the sound design. So you have people who you've paid deposits to. And when the strike happens, they don't care. They want to finish the job and get paid. But if you can't have your actors work, so that caused a little bit of conflict with a few of the sound companies because they were like, we don't care about the strike. We want paid. And I'm like, you know, we're not getting paid until we finish the job. So, you know, it was tough.
No, I bet. Speaking of tough, what is doing this, what is the biggest challenge to you? What is the biggest thing, like the biggest headache that you're just like, all right, if I could smooth this out?
Obviously, it's always financing. I mean, the more money you have, the easier it certainly can get.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, money solves problems. Like we said earlier, money solves problems, but kind of inhibits creativity. It's like, I got money. I'll just do it this way.
Sure. But that's always it. And it's like, like when you go through the casting process and like if you make a film for $1 million, say, you got to have an actor that sells it for at least $1.5 million. And the people who actually sell a movie are so minimal. You know, like I remember, I think we had like a $3 million budget that we were shopping this for at first. And everybody, maybe it was only $1.5 million. And everybody was like, literally from the casting to the sales agent, they're like, Adam Driver. And I'm like, yeah, get real. Adam Driver doesn't even make $1.5 million movie. Obviously, I understand he could finance the movie. He sells it. But like, right, come up with a more creative name. And those names aren't really out there. So that's why you see like Timothée Chalamet in every movie. It's because there's only so many of these people that the studios feel confident, like that can actually sell a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so, it's like, I know like John was saying, like you were happy to be getting, you know, the, I forgot her name again, Bacon.
And
Sosie. I keep wanting to say Sophia, but yeah, Sosie and, so, and who was the lead actor again?
His name is Alex Rowe. He's a British actor. He's, he's been in a bunch of movies. He's wonderful. But he is currently on MGM's Billy the Kid show. He plays Pat Garrett on Billy the Kid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I have Billy the Kid on Kaleidoscape.
Yeah.
Okay. And
then there's a guy named Dave Davis out of New Orleans, who's a really wonderful, wonderful actor. He's been in a bunch of big stuff. And then there's another gentleman by the name of Stephen Ogg, who is the other lead, who's been in a bunch of stuff as well.
Oh, cool. So, yeah, so I'm pulling it up again. I had it up. Where did it go?
Tell him about the GTA with Stephen Ogg.
Stephen Ogg was the, you know, the bald-headed face of
Grand Theft Auto.
Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, John, you told me about that. Yeah.
That dude is also on a couple, he had a really big role for a couple years on Walking Dead. And when we were filming in rural Kentucky, it was weird. Like, I didn't even think anybody knew we were filming, but people would come out of the woodworks to get Steven's autograph from Grand Theft Auto and Walking Dead. And there would be like lines of kids trying to get his autograph. And I'd be like, where the hell did they even come from? Or how did they even know?
Yeah. John was telling me that like a couple of weeks ago. He was saying it was weird. And it was, yeah, like that, like you would never, you weren't expecting that. He was saying,
yeah, no, not at all. But he certainly has a fan base.
Kevin Sizemore, any relation to Tom Sizemore?
No, not at all. But Kevin is a wonderful actor. He was in Mine 9. And he's a West Virginia native. So Kevin's like one of the guys I'll keep working with for a long time.
And then Mine 9, the guy from Cobra Kai was
Terry Serpico.
Terry Serpico was in his movie.
Oh.
He was John Kreese's sensei during the flashback scenes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, that's cool. Cool. How was Sosie Bacon?
She was great. She's awesome. She's a wonderful actor. She'll have her moment just like her parents do. And she's a hell of an actor. That's it. I think she hasn't even touched the surface of where she's going to go in her career. And you can see that she sort of was, you know, she was just raised in a master class of acting, really. And, she brought it. She's amazing in it. Wait till you see the movie. She's great.
Yeah. No, I can't wait
her
to see
it. Her and Alex. You know, her and Alex, Dave, Steven. I think everybody just did wonderful.
Yeah. No, I can't wait to see it. It's like, so how widely released is it going to be? Like, will I be getting it up here at, like, Showcase? I'm in Massachusetts.
I don't think we'll go to Boston. We'll be in New York. It'll be the furthest north we go, probably. We'll certainly be all over Appalachia, and then we'll be in the major cities like New York, Chicago. I'm not saying Boston's not a major city, but we just work our way there. Not sure they really care about the Appalachian story so much.
Yeah. I'll have to figure out how I can get down to see it.
Well, hopefully we'll be on Netflix and all that stuff again anyways, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd rather see it. I'd like to see it sooner rather than later.
Yeah, well, we can send you a link too if you want to.
Oh, there we go. Watch it in the theater.
There you go. Watch it in your theater. You'll be like Kramer. It'll be the premiere.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. No, I'm really looking forward to it. And I was hoping to see it around here, but if I have to drive, I'll drive. Whatever I got to do. It's so funny, John. I'm watching Eddie. It's like he started out and it was sunny.
Yeah.
He's in his car and it's black.
Like, but he's got to tell us why he decided to go to film school, because this came out of left field.
Yeah.
He was not interested in this in high school.
I don't even know. I mean, I don't. I'm sort of forgetting. Like, I got into film because I was writing and reading poetry, and I just really, really liked the expressiveness of it. And really, I started taking some advertising because my brother is actually the most creative writing person in our family. He just didn't do anything with it. So really, I think in a lot of sense, it's probably trying to follow where he started too. That's really it.
Wow. And then
probably a lot of the reason was I loved Michael Jordan, and Spike Lee was doing all the Michael Jordan commercials. And then I saw Do the Right Thing. And I was hooked because Spike Lee talked about culture, and I always want to tell my stories about my culture. And I was sort of hooked from Spike Lee, but really I got in, I don't know, really, you know, taking an advertising class from Johnny's teacher where he excelled so much.
And what was mom and dad's reaction when you told them you wanted to go to film school?
I'm sure they said no.
Well, I know I didn't expect it, and I didn't know anything about it. And my mom's like, we have to drive to New York to take Eddie to school. I was like, what? She goes, he's going to New York film school. I was like, Eddie is going to film school? So we got in her Explorer and drove to New York. And he was living in the Greenwich Village, and we carried all his stuff up. I don't know how many flights of stairs you lived on, Eddie, how high up that was, but it was a little hall. Then we get in his apartment. You could touch both sides of the wall just by putting your arms out almost. It was a dinky little apartment.
To put my feet up on the couch, I used a stove.
And it was like $1,500 a month. And this was what, 20 years ago?
Something like that. It was literally probably a couple hundred square foot, maybe. I don't know what it was.
And then they made the mistake of taking me with him when he went to like orientation. And we're in this little room, and there's this TV and there's a VCR. And they're like, watch this movie or something and tell us what you think. And the guy that came in, remember Sprockets on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah.
The black turtleneck. He was a little guy with a black turtleneck. And I started talking about Sprockets, and he's like, shut up. But I go, Eddie, he looks just like the guy in Sprockets. And I kept saying stuff like, do you want to pet my monkey? And stuff like that. And Eddie was getting really mad. And then we watched this movie. It's like a 15-minute movie of a shootout in like a city. But they didn't have actual guns. They used their fingers as finger guns and played out the shootout. And I was like laughing my ass off the whole time. Eddie was so mad because I was like ripping on everything. Do you remember that?
Oh, I fully remember it. And I tell you what, it was very Zoolander-ish. You know what I mean? The presentation and Sprockets, like in hindsight, you know, I was trying to get into it, but in hindsight,
you cut out your audio.
Yeah.
There you go. In hindsight, what?
In hindsight, it was very Sprockets, Saturday Night Live, Zoolander.
And the finger thing was just goofy. The shooting each other with their one. I mean, and you knew the guy that made the film eventually, didn't you?
No, you're confusing it with my buddy who I met there who made a similar film with a banana.
Oh, okay.
Oh, God.
Tell them what they did with the banana.
I don't know. It's like two clowns having a shootout with a banana or something.
Maybe
like
that's what we watched then.
No, because he was in the program with me, so he wouldn't have made it.
Well, the first one we watched was two guys shooting or people shooting each other with their fingers.
Yes, it was. It was a similar art piece.
So, Eddie, you were saying like you saw like Spike Lee and express like again, like John was saying, like what drove you, like what about this medium brought out like the artist in you?
I just wanted to write, I think, deep down, you know?
Okay.
I just think I always loved, I mean, I didn't know that I liked writing, but once I just always wanted to write, I think. Okay. And I always loved Appalachia. You know what I mean? I love Appalachia stories. And seeing someone like Spike Lee talk about their culture so specifically was just inspiring, you know?
Did living in Atlanta your first year of college have anything to do with it, that culture down there?
No, not at all.
He started out as a baseball player in college. Before you did that.
Not at all. I think I just loved watching movies. Like, I remember when I was at WVU, I'd just go to Blockbuster and get, you know, 12 movies and just watch movies and, you know, and just sort of figured it out, I guess.
Nice. So, like, now why all, like, because we have, I mean, there are writers. Carl Ellsworth's been on the show. He's a writer. And what made you go the full, like, all right, I want to write and also direct? And it's like, are you thinking at that point, like, all right, I'm writing this, but I want control after the fact too. I want to be able to really get this story the way I want it.
Yeah, it's totally it. You know, it's, to me, it's like, you're just, I don't know, like, I like the word auteur, and I don't say it to like try to think I'm smarter than anybody, because I'm obviously not. I'm just saying, I like the art of making film, like the writing, directing, producing, the location scouting. Like, I just like the whole package of it. And I know, like, I would never try to film and be a cinematographer or a gaffer, because I can't light and I can't technically operate the camera properly. So that's something that never jumped at me as something I wanted to do. But the expressiveness of directing and writing and editing is writing. So all of that just sort of works.
And then he had a professor at Savannah School of Art and Design that really inspired him to really push too, didn't you?
Yeah, his name was Hank Moongene, and he was a big famous Hollywood producer. And when he retired, he taught a class there every quarter, and he got me my first job out of film school at Disney. So, like, I got to move to L.A. and had a lot laid out for me already, which was quite nice.
And then you tell them about your contribution to a Kurt Russell movie.
There was a movie called Sky High I worked on. And, I mean, I worked on it from darn near script for like 2.5-3 years in many facets. But I was the model for the superhero outside of the high school.
The logo.
The logo.
Nice. Nice. It's funny, like you're saying, like, you know, from writing all the way through, it's like I say all the time, like I talk about artists and like they get a vision in their head and you just got to get it out. And it sounds like that's what you're saying, like about Appalachia and, you know, all you get these ideas. And it's interesting to me that it's like, okay, I want to write this. And then you just want to, you see it all the way through. And like you said, even the editing, it's like, okay, when you're writing it and then you get to the editing part, the editor, if you have a different editor, like you were saying, maybe you're going to have one someday, get away from that. But it's that full thing. It's like, do you at all, can you relate to, and people hate this and I'm going to go there, but like George Lucas redoing Star Wars because he couldn't do it the way he wanted to in the 70s. But then he redoes, like, remakes stuff, and people are so mad about it. But that's what was in his head, right? And it's like, I you got to appreciate that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, George Lucas is George Lucas, you know. I mean, he's a billion-dollar industry, you know.
Yeah.
but I don't even like watching my films, nor do I. You know, I'd like to turn my 9 into a TV show, but it's not like I want to continue to explore or recreate like opioid addiction movie again, you know. Or do I want to be the coal mining guy, even though there's mining in this movie too?
Right. No, but what I mean is like just the idea of like like even you're saying, like with my nine, you couldn't do what you wanted to do at the time because of budget constraints and everything, or it just wasn't available, but you'd like to do the TV show. And that's similar to like with Lucas, he's not redoing the movies, but he's actually now, because they have the technology, he can go back and re-edit the movie and add in some effects to get it to look the way he wanted back in the 70s. That wasn't possible.
Yeah, and that's incredible.
Yeah. And it's the idea of like, even you're saying like do a TV show of Mind 9, like you still have this vision in your head of what you wanted to do, but weren't able to do. But if you could do the TV show, you're like, I finally got that out of my head. Absolutely. Right. Like that idea.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's so funny because I think people that aren't artists, which I feel like most people aren't artists, they don't get it. They don't like it's an itch. It's a something that you just got to do.
Yeah. I would love to get it. What George Lucas did is pretty cool. I heard they're going to do something like that, or somebody. No, I heard Tarantino and Roger Avery on Joe Rogan's podcast, and they're talking about Eyes Wide Shut. The studio finished it different than oh my gosh, I'm blank. Kubrick passed away before it got finished, so they like took out the voiceover. The studio took out the voiceover in it, and the sound is different. And Avery was saying how he wanted to go back at some point and finish the film properly for how Kubrick wanted to. So I think all that stuff's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I nerd out on all that, and I love that Lucas took technology from today and did stuff. I mean, that's fun.
Yeah. And it's so they'll, the other thing is when I was growing up, my dad used to tell me, he's like, everything has a purpose. Everything means something. Right. So like, and meaning you walk into anything is like, why did you wear these clothes today? Why did you do this? What, everything has a purpose. Everything has meaning. And then I go off and, you know, go to college. I go to art school. I take creative writing. I do all this stuff. And it's like, I start reading about writing, and then that starts getting put into, you're like, everything has a meaning. Like when you write a line, it's like, why did they say, why is the girl going to the store in a red coat? And the person writing it put a red coat on this because of whatever everything has a meaning. When you're writing these things, is there like tell people about like what you're thinking, and if it's like all the different meanings of whatever, like what inspired certain lines or something that obscure that people might not know, like when they're watching a movie, when watching either Hazard or Mind 9, that maybe something is personal written in there that you did on purpose that most people wouldn't know.
I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but I'm quite confident there's almost every line has something to, you know, at least a quarter of all of the lines are something personal.
Yeah.
You know, like, I always if it's like an older person, for instance, like I always think of like my grandparents. I'll always write them into it, even just like the way they would walk or talk or anything like that. So you always pull personal things, I think, into all these characters. Because they're all, you know, it's always a reflection of where your heart's at. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing's random. Yeah. The point. Right. Nothing's just like, I don't know. It's like, why is that character wearing this? Or why are they wearing the baseball cap? Oh, because I could play baseball in college. Or it's like, you know what I mean? Like all of these different things. And it's like nothing is ever random. And sometimes it's like you'll be writing it. Like I know I did when I took creative writing and stuff. I'd write stuff and then later I'd be like, oh my God, I can't believe I put that in. You'd read it after, you know, you're proofreading it after before you turn it in or whatever. I'd be like, oh man, I didn't even believe I wrote what I just wrote there and how it reflects back on my childhood. I've done it with my brother. He's an artist, and I go in his house. I'm like, Mikey, you're doing your old bedroom here. It's like, you go in and he's like, oh my God, you're right. It's when I was a kid. And it's like, sometimes you do stuff you don't even realize you're doing. And I can't even imagine what it's like on the scale of, you know, making movies. And like, do you ever look up at your film and go, oh wow, look at that. That's neat. I didn't realize that was in the back of my head and I just put it into a movie.
Yeah, I guess so. I just can't think of anything off the top of my head for that.
Yeah, it's, well, hey, and it's also personal too, you know? So it's like, but I mean, that's part of the whole, to me, that's part of the whole process. And like, I like to show, like when I do drawings and stuff, I tell people, I put little things in the background and be like, see this squiggly here? That actually is this. And they go, oh my God. And then you'd never know it's there until you see it later. And once you know it's there, it's one of those things that you can't take your eye off.
Yeah. I love listening to the Coen brothers on like supplemental and for mm-hmm. like DVDs. And they talk about all that, like they're geniuses at that type of stuff. Like their attention to, Wes Anderson is an attention to detail person like that, that, you know, they always have every single frame has something personal and unique in it.
Yeah. That's Ready Player One. At the end of that, that battle scene at the end is, it was the visual effects department trying to get something from all of Spielberg's movies in there.
And that's awesome.
And Spielberg didn't want it. So they had to get it in and get it past him without him seeing it. And then, because he didn't want that stuff, so it was a game between the two of them, so between the department, like, we can get this in, we can get this in. And they actually, somebody did it online. It's like, I read about it, and like, there's this is in here, and this is in here. It's like, all the different things that they tried to get into there, and some of the stuff that didn't get through, and then some of the stuff that, you know, you can look it up online, there's stuff that got through. And he was like, oh, damn, it got past me. But imagine that, being able to get something past Spielberg, that Spielberg's stuff. And, you know, they're just trying to honor him. And he's like, no, don't put it in there.
Yeah, that is cool, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All that stuff is so much fun. But, all right. Eddie, this has been amazing.
I appreciate John, you got anything it. Now, else? Now I can yeah, drive home.
I still have a request for him to make a comedy someday.
Oh, I think this was it.
John doesn't understand that he might be that person making the comedy. John is amazing. Like, Johnny should have written for Saturday Night Live is how this should have worked out in life. But I can't write a comedy for anything. And I don't, you know, that's a whole other art form altogether.
It's a little bit dangerous time to write one, too.
I'm just not good at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Comedy's tough because if it doesn't land, it comes off. That's tough.
Yeah.
That's tough. But yeah, it's comedy. You're doing a war movie. That's exciting. Yeah. I mean, you got, yeah. I mean, so far, I mean, can't wait for Hazard. That comes out the 10th. So I'm really looking forward to that. And then Mine 9 for anybody listening. If you haven't seen it and you can't find it anywhere, email me.
You'll find it again soon. You'll find it again soon.
Yeah. All right, I'll stop giving out the link then. Yeah, definitely if you find it, grab it. But yeah, so how long do you think Hazard before that will be on Netflix and stuff?
I'm not sure yet. I have no idea, to be honest with you. I know last time when we signed the deal with Netflix, you go in a queue. So even after you sign a deal, you might not release for like 4 months, you know, because they have so many things. They have their release schedule already laid out. So I really don't have any idea. Like, my only focus is January 10th. You know, we're opening on about 40-some screens, and we're going to branch out and expand from there. And, you know, if we do our job, we can worry about Netflix in 3 or 4 months.
Cool. I'm looking forward to it. I'll be I'm sure I will. I'll be keeping up with it through John, how everything's going and how everything's doing. And, I can't wait to see it. Can't wait to hear how it does. Hope it does really well for you, Eddie.
Thank you so much.
It's been awesome talking to you. And
it's absolutely pitch black here. I'm in the middle of a rainstorm. I'm looking at my screen. And I can't even see my own face in it.
I know. It's like, yeah, I know. Cause you're like, your screen is just black here. I'm like, I'm talking to a blank face. It's like, you're like the mystery guest.
I am. It's pretty funny
on the video. So, but yeah, it's pretty amazing. John, thank you so much for bringing Eddie on. And Eddie, thank you so much for coming on. This has been real. I mean, I'm just a donkey in the basement. And that loves movies and loves home theater. And I'm sitting here talking to you. So pretty amazing.
Thank you both very much.
Does he need to stay on when we end so it doesn't?
Yeah, just so I can see how the recordings are doing. Yeah,
stay on there, Ed, even when we're done.
Yeah, don't hang up when we're done. But yeah, thanks everybody for listening. We would, check it out. Look around, email me if you're looking for it. Hazard coming out January 10th, 2025, in a couple weeks or 10 days actually from the time you're hearing this. But we'll be back later this afternoon with the live show. And until then, you know what you got to do.
Go push play. What he said.
Later.
Hey, Fred.
This has been a Hey Fred production with theme music by Jeff Bernhardt and Throne Vault Productions.